I came across an article this week as I prepared for our discussion. It's an article that talks about, you know, you're in a small town when. There are a few little anecdotes you might appreciate. You know you're in a small town when the nearby airport runway has grass growing on it. You know you're in a small town when every sport is played on dirt, and the big rivalry is between teams sponsored by the hardware store and the cafeteria. You know you're in a small town because you don't use your turn signal, because everyone already knows where you're going. You know you're in a small town when the pickup trucks on Main Street outnumber the cars 3-1. That's my kind of town, isn't it? That's great. You know you're in a small town when you miss a Sunday at church and receive a get-well card by Wednesday. You know you're in a small town when you dial a wrong number and you talk for 30 minutes anyway. You know you're in a small town because when someone asks you how you're doing, they'll pull up a chair and listen to what you have to say. I'm not sure a little town like that exists, probably in our imagination, probably in all our hopes, because as I read these, I don't know about you, but I feel like I'd like to belong to a little town like that. Our town is vastly different, isn't it? With our hurried lifestyles and our push and pull and our go and come, I think of another article I read recently where this actually happened to a family. There was a moving van outside their home, and they were tidying up in the front yard, and a gal who lived about 6 houses down came by and said, "Hello, want to welcome you to our neighborhood." And they didn't know what quite to say until finally the gal who was cleaning up the front yard said, "Well, we hate to tell you this, but we're not moving in. After 2 years of living here, we're moving out." Maybe that's a little bit more like our town. Maybe you can identify with Harry Truman, who once complained about Washington, D.C., his town. He said, "You know, if you live in Washington, D.C., and you want a friend, buy a dog." Well, at a time in Elijah's life when he was convinced nobody cared about him, and if you'd ask him, he'd probably say a dog wouldn't even be interested in him, God had special plans for him, and that plan involved a very special friend. So I invite your attention back to the books of Kings and 1 Kings. We finished our study of that book, but I purposefully skipped over a paragraph that introduced Elisha. You probably, like me, get Elijah and Elisha confused. Not after our studies. I hope you'll know the difference. But I want to invite your attention back to chapter 19, as Jeremiah introduces for us this man named Elisha. While you're turning, let me refresh your memory a little bit. As we studied the life of Elijah, perhaps you remember that chapter 19 was that dark, bleak, despairing chapter where Elijah had come to the end of his rope, and there underneath that juniper tree, he prayed to God, and he said, "Oh Lord," it's in verse 4, he said, "I've basically had enough. I want you to end my life. I've had enough. Please take my life." We called our study of this chapter throwing in the towel, because Elijah was basically doing just that. He'd had enough. Baal was too big to beat. He wanted out. Well, God didn't answer his prayer to die. We talked a little bit about how good it is that God doesn't answer all of our prayers. Think of the things he would have missed. One of those things would be this young man he will meet. What God did allow Elijah to do was sleep. His sleep was interrupted 2 times with food delivered by an angel. And it was a wonderful time of refreshment for this tired old prophet. But when he woke up, God had a message for him. He told him, "Elijah, I want you to do 3 things." We read them briefly several weeks ago, but let's go back to the 3rd command. "Elijah, you're to meet a friend named Elisha and draft him into service." Look at the last part of verse 16. "And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place." Now, this doesn't mean, as it might at first glance, that Elijah is relieved of his duty under the juniper tree. It's as if God perhaps said, "Now look, Elijah, you've been doing wonderfully well. You were there by the brook Kidron, and you never complained, and that was super of you. And then I sent you to the widow's house, and I never heard a complaint from you there. And then on Mount Carmel, you were very courageous, and I'm proud of you. But what is this 'I'm tired, take my life' routine? Gabriel, go get a replacement down there right away." Oh no. God said to that very discouraged man, "Elijah, what you need after your rest and a couple of heaven-cooked meals is a friend named Elisha. Now, what God does say to Elijah here, instead of that kind of lecture, which we could expect, gives us some wonderful insight into the character of our loving God, who loves His children. But it also gives us some insight into the needy character of His children, frankly, you or me. He says to Elijah, in effect, go find an associate to help shoulder your burden, and I've already got him picked out. In other words, sooner or later, every child of God in here needs another child of God to come along and encourage, to share a burden. Elijah needed a friend. Well, Elijah, James told us, if you remember, was a man just like us. And whether we want to admit it or not, there are times when we need nothing more than a friend. While we were singing earlier, Pastor Scott, pastor of Children's Ministries, and myself were going to different classrooms and talking to 3- and 4-year-olds with a special interview question that I wanted to use in this study. The question was, what is a friend? And they were delightful in their answers. I'll allow them to be anonymous for the sake of their parents who are here. But here are some of their answers. What is a friend? Well, these kids were very serious about this, and so we had a great time talking. Many of them said a friend is nice. That's what a friend is. A friend is someone who likes you very much. A friend is someone who comes over to play with your dog. I'm just glad he didn't say cat. I'd have scratched that one out of this list. A friend who comes to play with your toys and that kind of stuff, this kid said. A friend is someone who tells you the truth. I can't help but believe this kid got into trouble this past week, probably, and he heard that little lecture. A friend is someone who gives you presents. He's getting all cranked up for Christmas, I can tell. This guy said, this little boy, well, I'm a friend to lots of girls. I give girls flowers. I said, oh, yeah, really? Why is that? It's great. He said, well, because my daddy gives my mommy flowers on Mother Days. And I'm sure there are a lot of them. A friend, one kid said, cheers you up when you're sad. And a friend, finally, is someone who cares for you when you're hurt. An English publication sent out a survey to adults, asking them to define what a friend is, promising a reward. The answer is one you've heard often. Let me read it to you again. A friend is one who comes in when the whole world has gone out. To Elijah in chapter 19, the whole world had gone out. He was convinced he was the only one faithful to God. He had forgotten the promises of God. He'd forgotten the provision of God. He'd forgotten about the people of God who were in hiding, who were there. And God's solution to Elijah's despair is you need a friend. Now, while our normal inclination before we jump into this study is to identify with Elijah, and we all will, we can't help it as we'll study through this. I think the challenge, the thrust of the word here is to encourage us to be Elisha. Not to receive a friend, but to become a friend. So I want you to meet Elijah's friend this morning. He's a farm boy. You'll look in verse 19. He's from the Jordan Valley. The Bible gives us a little background information. He's from a rather wealthy farm family. Look at verse 19. So Elijah departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and he with the 12. Now get this picture in your mind here. Elisha is acting as the crew chief in a field. He's plowing with 11 servants, and each of them have a pair of strong oxen, and they're plowing in echelon formation over this vast field. In today's economy, we've got 12 jumbo tractors working their way across these vast fields. This is no small operation here. This was a wealthy family, a landowning family. His father's name was Shaphat, and he was from the city of Abel Meloha. And that means, or Mehola, means meadow of dancing. And that name suggests a joy and happiness that comes from living in this fertile valley and the kind of fruit and increase that come to people who work this land with their hands. This is the kind of home that Elisha came from. And undoubtedly his father is a wealthy landowner. would have been a leading man, perhaps even an elder in his city. Other clues indicate he was respectful of God, maybe a believer or a follower. Now notice the last part of verse 19. It tells us that Elijah was walking across the field, evidently, where Elisha was plowing. The text reads, Elijah passed over to him and threw his mantle on him. Now, not a word is spoken between the two of them. No word needs to be spoken. Elisha knew what this meant. In fact, all of Israel knew what this act meant. That camel hair mantle represented everything that Elijah, the teacher, the prophet, stood for. It represented his office. Sir John Malcolm wrote of the customs of this day with these words. He said, when a great teacher died, he bequeathed his cloak to the disciple he most esteemed, and its transfer marked out his heir to the role of teacher. Ladies and gentlemen, Elijah, by doing that act, is calling Elisha into the ministry of being a prophet. Then it seems Elijah just kept walking across the field. Well, as soon as Elisha recovered from his shock, I think it would be obvious shock, he ran after him. Look at verse 20. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you. And he said to him, go back again, for what have I done to you? Now, Elisha's response is an immediate, yes, I'll do it. But first, he wanted to go home and tell his family goodbye. Now, this wasn't like another disciple in the New Testament you've read about that wanted to go back to his father and mother. Well, that text tells us he wanted to live there until his father and mother died so that he could receive his inheritance. What he is doing here, and Matthew Henry made a good point, is that he went back not to request leave. He went back to take leave, to tell him goodbye. Now, don't misunderstand Elijah's comment either that occurs in the latter part of verse 20 when he says, go back again, for what have I done to you? Now, it seems rather cold to an English reader. Here's a guy who just said, okay, I'll follow you. And he says immediately, well, go back. What have I done to you? The words, what have I done to you, are a literal challenge to Elisha to think about what just happened, to carefully consider the prophetic call to the prophetic ministry. The words could be amplified in the English culture to read something like this. Elisha, go back home, and while you're there, carefully think about what I've called you to do. Now, your immediate answer was yes, that's wonderful, but I want you to go think about it a little bit more and make sure. In other words, Elisha, I love that youthful zeal. That's wonderful. But I'm calling you to leave your parents. I'm calling you to leave your land. I'm calling you to leave your inheritance, your family fortune. I'm calling you to leave all the creature comforts that you're used to with servants. And I'm asking you to follow this old, crusty prophet. And I'm not sure where I'm going to spend the night tonight or the next night. So go make sure. So Elisha returned home. And will you notice what he did in verse 21? So he returned from following him. And he took the pair of oxen, and he sacrificed them, and boiled their flesh with the implements of the oxen, and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah. Now, you've heard of the phrase, burning your bridges behind you. Well, Elisha ate his. He had a neighborhood barbecue. He took those oxen, which represented his livelihood, his future, his hope, his fortune, and he killed them. And he gathered all the families around from the farming community. He gathered his servants, and all of the children were running here and there. This was one big dinner on the grounds, and he was celebrating the call to the ministry. And he was literally barbecuing his bridges behind him. And I guess they used splinters from the plow to pick their teeth when they finished this wonderful meal. Here's a thought for you. The call of God in Elisha's life was the setting for a celebration, not sorrow. We're not told anything about his father or mother's reaction, although they must have been close because of Elisha's desire to go back and tell them goodbye. Can you imagine the somewhat typical response to Elisha running home and saying, I'm giving it all up and I'm going to follow this itinerant prophet around the country? Elisha, are you crazy? Have you forgotten this is the family farm here? You're the next in line to inherit the fortune. You're to keep the name going. And you're going to follow a man named Elijah. Now, we've heard about that man. Isn't he just a wanderer? Seems like I've heard fire just follows him around everywhere he goes. You're going to follow him? What kind of future is there in being a prophet? C.T. Studd, several generations ago, served as a missionary. He's one of my heroes. I have a picture of him in his outside his hut in Africa in my office. He was the heir to a vast fortune, and he left England to go to Africa, and they thought he was crazy. When his father died, he received his inheritance, which was worth more than $1 million in today's economy. He immediately gave it all away. He gave it to some of the men serving in his generation for their ministries. He gave a good portion of it to a man named Hudson Taylor as he tried to reach China. He gave some of it to a man who was developing orphanages by the name of George Mueller. And he gave the rest of it to a young evangelist named D.L. Moody. Can you imagine that kind of investment? See, nobody today would dare go up to C.T. Studd in heaven and say, "Boy, did you blow it! Did you waste your inheritance? Think of what you could have done or had or where you could have gone or what you could have owned." Nobody would ever say that now. I have a picture of his boyhood home made of marble and stone. And then there's a little photograph of him in the inset where he's sitting outside his hut with chickens. "Hey, Mom, I think God wants me to be a pastor." "A what?" "Sit right there. Let me get some aspirin. Maybe it'll go away." "Hey, Dad, I'm thinking about becoming a missionary." "A who?" "Don't they go somewhere far away?" "That's what I'm thinking. After graduation, I'm thinking of going overseas for a little bit." "Now, just sit down here, young lady, and let's talk about the kind of future that's in that. By the way, how often am I going to get to see you?" "Oh, I'll reemerge from the field a couple of months every 3 or 4 years." No way. Has it ever occurred to you, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who are parents, that your greatest contribution to the kingdom of God may come in the form of your children, whom you are willing to lovingly support when they come to you with crazy things like that? Now, by the way, am I suggesting that every good Christian gives up secular employment and goes into vocational ministry? No, I'm not. Every Christian has a unique calling. What I challenge you to do is discover yours if you haven't already. And then, as one author said, you make whatever sacrifice is necessary to fulfill your particular calling to the ministry of Jesus Christ. Whether it's teaching a Sunday school class or parking cars or stuffing envelopes or shaking hands or whatever it might be. Now, evidently, Elisha had the support of his family as they gathered around. This was the setting for a celebration. Elisha's going to be a prophet. Everybody gather around. Now, you do need to understand that there is a New Testament parallel to the call of Elisha that is the call to everyone here. It's not to wear a camel hair mantle. It's to wear a yoke. I want you to hold your finger here and turn to Matthew chapter 11, would you? Let me show you something. Look at verse 29. Jesus Christ is speaking, and he says some fascinating words. This is quite an invitation here, by the way. He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls." Now, in this invitation, there are at least two denials. If you want to walk with Christ as an ever-growing, ever-learning disciple, the word learn, manthano, is from the same, or gives us the same root, mathetes, disciple. A disciple is a learner. He says, "Learn of me." Well, if you want to be a learner of Christ, there are two denials. First of all, there is the denial of self-interest. Now, the metaphorical use of the word yoke was common in Christ's day. A student during the first century was referred to as being under the yoke of his professors or his teachers. One rabbi urged his young students as he wrote, "Put your neck under the yoke and let your soul receive instruction." The idea of wearing a yoke has powerful implications to every New Testament Christian. You see, a yoke was handmade by the master for every oxen, for every animal. It was custom built to fit the broad shoulders of that animal. What a wonderful thought that Jesus Christ has handmade the yoke that he wants you to wear. And it's different. Your form of curriculum, your studies are different from anyone else's on planet Earth. It is unique to you. And he, the all-caring master, the all-wise divine discipler, has carefully crafted your yoke. And he says, if you're willing to deny yourself, I want you to wear it. Secondly, to grow up in Christ demands a denial of self-management. Notice the text again. Take my yoke, the one I designed, upon you, and learn about me. He doesn't wear the harness, you do. He has the reins in his hands, not you. He turns you to the left or to the right, you don't decide. He decides how long you'll stay out in the field and work, in fact, which field you'll work in, and when you'll stop working. See, he is the master. We're the ones who yield to him the reins of our lives. Now, did you notice the thrust of the curriculum? Jesus said, and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And this is a study all its own, but at least let me say that the teacher here obviously is Christ, and the subject matter is Christ. Dr. Van Dora of Stanford University said that the highest, most effective means of teaching is modeling. It's amazing that Jesus knew that without ever attending Stanford. But that's what he's doing. In other words, to everybody who will slip into their divinely crafted yoke, Jesus Christ says, I will open my life up to you, and you can take good, long looks and learn all you want about me. But it only comes to those who will be managed by the discipler, who have his interests at heart. So Jesus, the greater Elijah, asks, will you wear my yoke? Old Testament Elijah asked Elisha, will you wear my mantle? In effect, will you become my disciple? Will you learn everything you can about me and my ministry and my role? And will you be willing to step into my sandals and represent me one day? And Elisha said, I'm ready to go. Well, what did Elisha become? Go back to 1 Kings again, 19. What is it that he agreed to become? Look at the last phrase of verse 21. Then he arose and followed Elijah, and you want to underline this phrase in your text, and ministered to him. Boy, that's a loaded phrase. Hey, Elisha, you're the personal student of the great prophet Elijah. It must really be exciting, I guess. Well, I've heard about the flour and the oil. Have you been able to make any multiply overnight? Nope. Heard about the resurrection. Have you resurrected anybody from the dead yet? No. How about the ravens? They brought you any food? You know, I heard about that. No. Well, I don't suppose you've called fire down from heaven either, huh? No. Probably haven't even killed any prophets of Baal. Mm-mm. Well, what are you doing? I'm serving my friend, Elijah. Ladies and gentlemen, the distinguishing mark of a disciple is that he is willing to be known merely as his master's servant, as he was here. To become a lifelong learner of Jesus Christ, like Elisha was to Elijah, if you're willing to enter the classroom of specialized training uniquely drafted for you, prepared for you, then that discipleship is going to cost you several things. I want to give them to you. First of all, discipleship will require reshaping. The question is, are you pliable? See, my friends, I think we forget that by becoming a follower of Jesus Christ means, demands, requires that we change. God has committed himself to changing us. And think of what Elisha had changed about his life, everything. He was served, now he becomes the servant. Vast holdings, wealth at his fingertips, he was at the top of the heap, and now he is serving an itinerant man who travels around the country. I don't know if I'd be willing to make those kind of changes. Radical, revolutionary changes to Discipleship will require it. Secondly, discipleship will demand denial. Talked about that a little bit already. The question is, are you willing? Walking with Jesus Christ has lost its accompanying challenge to sacrifice our lives and our time and our talents. The question is this, what is it about your life and mine that we've been willing to give away or give up or sacrifice in order to advance the cause of Jesus Christ one inch this past week? Now, our most precious commodity in our kind of town is time. What kind of time are you willing to invest in advancing the cause? For some, it might be treasure. I think of Henry Dunant, an interesting man at the turn of the century who was a wealthy Swiss banker. And he was convinced of a certain business enterprise that if he could only convince Napoleon to go along, that they would both increase their millions together. And so he headed for the south of France to meet with Napoleon to try to arrange his collaboration on this particular business venture. When he arrived from Switzerland, he was told that Napoleon was already in the field preparing for battle. He immediately ordered a coach. He wasn't going to let this opportunity go by. And he ordered the coach to take him to the battlefield. So intent was he to get Napoleon's permission and involvement to advance his fortune. As he crested a hill, he saw that he was too late. And he sat there in his coach and he watched below him as the cavalries from the competing armies collided. He heard the crash. He saw the sabers flashing in the sun. He heard the gunfire. He heard the screams of wounded and dying men. And all of a sudden, that business venture did not seem all that critical. Henry Dunant never returned to Switzerland. In fact, for the next 3 weeks, he stayed there at the battlefield, helping bandage the wounded, help the crippled, and provide relief and housing for families who now were without daddies. He would give the rest of his life to establish a cause that became his passion. In 1901, he received the very first Nobel Prize for Peace. With it, a handsome sum of money, which he immediately gave back to the cause that he had established, now known around the world as the Red Cross. He was a disciple committed to his cause and to his cross. How about us? Finally, discipleship will involve intimacy. The question is, are you available? Now, this is the most amazing thing here. What Elisha became to Elijah over a period of 10 years is a man who moved from faithful servant to dear, loyal friend. Would you turn ahead to 2 Kings and look at chapter 2? Elijah is going home to glory very soon. The prophets knew it. Elijah knew it. Elisha knew it. And Elijah decides to go once more to three of the schools of the prophets that he founded to talk to the young men, probably planning on giving his final farewell challenge and speech. In a very moving scene, Elijah three times tries to get Elisha to leave him, knowing that he would die. We're not sure why, but he thinks perhaps that he wants to save Elisha the grief of seeing him go. Look at verse 2. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." There was a school of the prophets there. But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." Skip to verse 4. And Elijah said to him, "Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." Elijah, I'm walking with you to the very end now. We're going to finish this journey. One of the most touching phrases occurs twice in each of those two times I read. Look at verse 3. They arrived at Bethel. The sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, they probably pulled him aside and whispered, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Be still." Literally, be quiet. Verse 5. The sons of the prophets who were at Jericho approached Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" And he answered, "Yes, I know. Be still. Be quiet." Imagine that. Elisha's a prophet in training here. He's received his theological instruction from the teacher of his generation. You would expect this mature heir to the role of Elijah to respond, "Yes, God's taking Elijah away. Praise God from whom all blessings flow." Romans 8:28. No, he said, I know he is. But don't talk to me about it, please. It hurts too much to think about it. See, Elisha and Elijah had become dear friends. And if you've been blessed with one or maybe two in your lifetime, you know that they are impossible to replace. Let me show you something else. Turn to chapter 3. We're still in 2 Kings. Let me show you one more thing. This is well into the ministry of Elisha now. Elijah's already gone. He's already in glory. We'll study that event next Lord's Day, Lord willing. In verse 11, King Jehoshaphat is asking for a prophet of God who can tell him what to do. The latter part of verse 11, the servants answer, saying, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, note this, who used to pour water on the hands of Elijah. Wow. Now, don't miss this. Even though God would use Elisha to perform twice the miracles as Elijah, even though Elisha would see the stamping out of Baalism during his ministry, and he would see the death of that wicked woman, Jezebel, occur, even though he would have all of this happen to him, by now in his ministry, he is still known abroad as the man who served Elijah. Now, perhaps Elijah was troubled with arthritic hands. We don't know. But Elisha evidently would heat some water in that campfire kettle, and then he would pour some of that water over Elijah's hands to soothe them. My friend, Elisha's first and foremost ministry was to simply become Elijah's friend. That leads me to another thought about the call of Elisha. His call and ours may be to private obscurity, not public opportunity, for 10 years. Elisha, what are you doing with your life? I'm pouring water to try to soothe this poor man's hands. I'm doing more than that. I'm pouring water over his heart to try to encourage him. Has God called you, by the way, to a background ministry like that? I like to call it the ministry of presence. You're just there. When someone needs you, you're there. And you're on the lookout for people who need you to be there. And you just sort of come alongside with a word or a note or a call or something. You're kind of like Jonathan was to David. You're like Luke or Epaphroditus was to the Apostle Paul. Everybody knew Paul. Who's Epaphroditus? A man who ministered to me. Maybe your greatest ministry on earth will be that one. And long after you're gone, people will remember you. They will think of you as, oh, I remember that man. He used to encourage people. I remember that woman. She used to be able to lift our hearts. Elijah had prayed to die. God sent him a friend and the smell of prime rib soon filled the air. Now, every one of us in this auditorium are exactly the same in one regard. We all need a friend. But the challenge of this story is not to become Elijah and say, okay, Lord, this is great. Now I know who to look for. Send me an Elisha. No. The challenge is to become a friend. Perhaps you could start your search by heating up some water, maybe making some barbecue, and then going and looking for someone who needs your soothing treatments of friendship as a disciple who has given up the right to self-interest and self-management, and is willing to say, Lord, I'll wear that yoke. Go ahead and slip it on. I'll be your disciple. The world is filled with Elijahs who are waiting for an Elisha. Maybe you can be that one. Let's pause long enough to allow the Lord to put a period or an exclamation point somewhere. He has been gracious to give us enough of this narrative to understand what precious things Elisha had with Elijah. And as I've studied this passage, I came across another one in the New Testament where Jesus Christ said to his disciples some amazing words where he said to them, I no longer call you my servants, I call you my friends. Imagine that. Jesus considers you his child, his dear friend. And he is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. In the strength of that, ask him to make of you a friend to someone else.